Augusta laughed. It was not a polite laugh. It was the kind a woman uses when she's been sitting too long in a black gown and has finally been handed permission to be cruel. Her hand rose, then settled flat against the polished walnut of the morning room table. And she laughed again, sharper this time, into the silence the solicitor had carefully arranged between the words of the will. "That cannot be the whole of it, Mr. Honnis. Surely my late husband intended to leave more than that to a stepdaughter." Catherine Whitmore did not move. She stood near the window, her palm pressed flat against the doorframe at her shoulder, the way she had stood for 6 years in this house, close to a way out, just in case. Outside, an October rain was thinning to a mist, and the park's autumn elms shed their leaves one at a time, deliberate as coins onto a counter. She heard her stepmother laugh, and did not turn. She had been trained by patience to listen first. The morning room had been arranged for an audience. The walnut table, long enough for 12, set today for 4, had been polished until the wood looked wet. The chairs at the head and foot were Augusta's own, brought down from the south wing for the occasion. The fire had been built up beyond what the room required, because Augusta liked to perspire faintly during inheritance and considered a high color appropriate to the bereaved. Catherine, who had been bereaved without permission to perspire, had not changed her position by the window in the past 40 minutes. Mr. Hollis cleared his throat. He was a small, white-haired man whose spectacles had been polished too many times that morning. He looked for an instant at Catherine, a glance that passed too quickly to be seen by anyone else. Then he returned to the document. "My lady, if I may continue, the instructions are quite specific." "Continue," Augusta said, and arranged her face into something patient. "By all means. I am sure my husband knew what he was doing when he forgot his only widow." The solicitor's voice resumed, dry and exact. "To my daughter, Catherine Anne Whitmore, I leave the principal sum of the estate, the freehold of Whitmore Hall and its appurtenant lands, the contents of the library, the Eastern Farms, the colliery share, and the proceeds of the Lincolnshire Trust, the management of which has, for the past 8 years, been held by my dearest friend and named trustee, James Forsyth, Duke of Ravenscar." Augusta's smile did not falter. It froze. The expression traveled in a curious order. First, the corners of her mouth, which set. Then the line of her jaw, which tightened. Last, her eyes, which became briefly, perfectly empty, before she remembered that she was being observed, and refilled them with the appropriate widow's grief. "To my widow, the Lady Augusta Whitmore," Mr. Hollis went on, "I leave the south wing of Whitmore Hall, for so long as she shall not remarry, the pin money established at our marriage, and my regret that I did not better know her before I gave her my name." The silence in the room was not the silence of stunned grief. It was the silence of a card table when the marked card has been turned face up, and everyone has, in a single instant, recalculated. Cassius Trent, Augusta's son from her first marriage, set down his coffee. He was 24, and beautiful in the way certain young men are, who have been told too often and too early that they are. He wore an indigo coat cut a season too late for London, and his fair hair had been arranged with the care of a man who believed that arrangement was character. He looked at his mother. His mother, by long understanding, did not look back. Cassius then looked at the document on the table, and his pretty mouth thinned, and Catherine, who had been watching the window glass for 6 years, saw the whole calculation happen in his reflection in the polished walnut. "There is a mistake in the document," Cassius said, in a voice that had been practiced. "There was," Mr. Hollis told them firmly, "no mistake." Cassius answered that his stepfather would not have placed the bulk of his estate under the trust of a stranger, and Mr. Hollis answered, with the patience of a man who had been preparing the sentence for 3 weeks, that His Grace, the Duke of Ravenscar, was not a stranger. He had served under Sir Edmund in Spain. Sir Edmund had stood as guardian to him during the Forsyth minority. The trust was drawn in 1808, witnessed in 1809, and amended only twice in the 18 years of their acquaintance. It was, he said without raising his voice, the most carefully written instrument he had ever drafted, and he had drafted instruments for 37 years. Cassius asked, with the false ease of a man trying his second strategy of the morning, where the trustee was, then, and was the trustee informed, and why was the trustee not, at present, in this room? Mr. Hollis answered each question in order. The trustee had been informed of his obligations under the will. The trustee was not in this room. Mr. Hollis allowed himself, for the first time that morning, the faintest movement of lip, not a smile, but the precursor of one, swiftly suppressed. No, he is not in this room. Catherine moved at last. She turned from the window slowly, because rapid movement made Augusta look at one with too much interest, and crossed to the table where the document lay. She did not sit. She did not need to read it. She had felt, all the morning, that something in the air was going to be rearranged. She had not expected it to land in her hand. "May I see it?" she asked, and Mr. Hollis pushed the document an inch toward her with the careful gravity of a man passing a candle in the wind. "Of course, Miss Whitmore. It is your father's hand from page 3 onwards. The codicil is in mine." Catherine read the principal clause. The page smelled faintly of beeswax and tobacco, her father's desk smell, preserved on the paper as if some part of him had been folded into it. She read it twice. The second time she allowed her hand to lift from the doorframe behind her and to settle, instead, on the table beside the document, palm down, steady. It was the closest she had come to weeping since the funeral, and she did not weep. She returned the document to Mr. Hollis. She thanked him quietly and stepped back and let the silence resume its work in the room.
"Catherine," Augusta said.
Catherine looked up. Augusta's voice had recovered its London pitch, controlled, clear, designed to be remembered correctly later. "This," Augusta said, gesturing at the document with two fingers as though it were a withered leaf, "is plainly something we shall contest. Mr. Hollis can have no objection to that. In the meantime..." The footman opened the door. He did not announce. The footman never opened doors to the morning room without announcing, because Augusta would have his livery for it, and the entire household knew that. The footman opened the door because the man behind him had not waited to be announced. The Duke of Ravenscar walked into the room. He was not what Augusta had been preparing for. Augusta had been preparing, all morning, for an elderly trustee, some old soldier of her late husband's regiment, gouty and conventional and persuadable. The man who entered the morning room was 28 years old. He was tall in the way that made doorways seem badly sized. He was broad through the shoulders in the way that made coats look as though they had been honestly earned. And his eyes, when they swept the table once and settled on Catherine, were the color of a Lincolnshire autumn, which is to say gray, and warmer than gray had any right to be. He bowed, to Catherine first, and gave her her name. She inclined her head a careful inch and gave him his title, and he straightened and went on without preamble. "I am sorry I am late. I was on the Lincoln Road since 5 this morning, and the bridge at Newark was down. I had not thought it would matter. I see I was wrong." He turned then, as though at some delayed afterthought, to the rest of the room, and gave the others their names, Lady Augusta, Mr. Trent, Mr. Hollis, in an order that arranged them, by the slightest pressure of his attention, into a hierarchy they had not previously occupied. Mr. Hollis was suddenly standing. The Duke did not seem to require this, and did not, at any rate, mark it. He took 2 further steps into the room, stopped at a distance that was respectful of the table, without being subordinate to it, and addressed himself to the solicitor, over the heads of the seated, asking whether the principal clause had been read. Catherine answered before Mr. Hollis could. She said it had. The Duke asked after the codicil. She answered that it had not been. He nodded once and gestured for the solicitor to wait. "Then before he does, allow me to settle one matter." The Duke set his gloves on the table, leather worn at the wrist, riding gloves, not London ones, and then his hat, and then he looked at Augusta. He did not raise his voice. He did not need to. His voice, when it came, was the voice of a man who had been cross-examined in his own counting house at the age of 20 by a war-aged colonel, and had lived, since then, with the conviction that voice raised was voice wasted.
"Madam, you will leave the south wing of this house standing. You will not sell the library. You will not pawn the silver. You will not, between today and the time you are removed from these walls by Michaelmas next, make any decision regarding this estate that is not mine to make. The trust is my charge. Your husband, who was my dearest friend, placed it in my hand for a reason. I am here to honor him. I would advise you not to contest that intention in a court of chancery, because the document is sound, and because I will be the man at the table opposite your counsel. And I have been the man at that table before."
"Your grace is impertinent," Augusta said. The flatness in her voice was new. The laugh had drained out of her face, and the color with it. The room had warmed 2 degrees while the Duke spoke. Augusta, having warmed disproportionately during the will's earlier reading, was now visibly damp at the temple.
"I am, madam," he said.
"I have been impertinent in the service of your husband for 18 years. I do not propose to stop today." He turned again to Catherine, and the whole room reorganized around the slow movement of his shoulders. His face, in the light of the high east windows, was not a handsome face in the London sense. It was a face that had been weathered into its arrangement, and a face that had carried something for a long time, and had learned not to say so. It was, Catherine thought, a face she had been waiting to see, without having known she had been waiting.
"Miss Whitmore," he said, "I have come to do 2 things. The first is to read the codicil, which Mr. Hollis will do in a moment, and which you are entitled to hear in privacy if you wish. The second is to ask whether you will permit me, this afternoon, to escort you and your old governess to Ravenscar Park, where you will be safe, and where the management of an estate that is now legally yours can begin under conditions other than these." Augusta's hand closed on the arm of her chair. The knuckles whitened in a way Catherine had seen often.
"Catherine," Augusta said, "is in mourning. Catherine is not going anywhere with you."
Catherine spoke before the Duke could. She did not raise her voice either. She had been raised by patience to listen first. She had also been raised by the same patience to choose the moment one stopped listening.
"Catherine," she said, "is standing here. Catherine is 25 years old, and Catherine will speak for herself."
The Duke did not smile. There was nothing of triumph in his face, but something altered behind his eyes. Small, exact, and held in for so many years that even now he kept it in the territory of the careful. He inclined his head and waited. Catherine looked at him steadily. The window light caught the side of his face. He did not flinch from her examination, and he did not perform for it. He simply accepted it, the way a man stands to be measured for a coat he has agreed to wear. She had the strange sense, clear, immediate, and unaccountable, that she had seen this face before, that she had been seeing it, in some quiet way, for a long time, and had only just now been permitted to know it. The sense did not unsettle her. It settled her. She drew one breath and let it go, and answered.
"Yes," she said. "I will go to Ravenscar Park."
The codicil, which Mr. Hollis read in his small, careful voice 10 minutes later, said 3 things. It said that Catherine was to be removed from Whitmore Hall on the day of the will's reading, and not before, and not after. It said that the Duke of Ravenscar was to remain her trustee until her marriage or her 30th year, whichever should come first. And it said, in a single sentence whose plainness made Mr. Hollis's hand shake very slightly, that Sir Edmund Whitmore had wished his daughter to know she had been loved by him and by the man who would now stand in his place. Augusta did not laugh again that morning. By 2 o'clock, Catherine's trunk had been carried down to the carriage. It was a small trunk. Most of what had been hers in this house had been, over 6 years, quietly absorbed into Augusta's wardrobe and Augusta's drawing room. Her mother's pearls had become Augusta's pearls. Her mother's writing desk had become Augusta's correspondence stand. Her mother's favorite chair had been reupholstered In Augusta's preferred apricot silk. Catherine took none of it. She took the trunk, the watch on her father's chain that the Duke had laid into her palm without explanation, and Mrs. Pell, her old governess, who had been weeping quietly into a handkerchief for an hour and was now, with her bonnet straight, standing by the door with the absolute composure of a woman who has been waiting 6 years to leave. The Duke handed Catherine into the carriage himself. His hand at her elbow was steady, careful, not familiar, not lingering. And he closed the door and mounted the bay he had ridden from Lincoln, and they went down the long avenue under a rain that had begun again in earnest. Catherine did not look back at the house. She did look once, briefly, at the figure of Augusta in the morning room window. Augusta was watching the carriage go. She was not weeping. Her face was the face of a woman calculating the next move, and Catherine, who had been calculating moves against her stepmother for 6 years, recognized the look exactly. It was not over. But for now, for one afternoon, on a road through Lincolnshire, with a watch warm in her hand and a man on a bay riding at the carriage's pace, for now, the morning had ended. The road from Whitmore to Ravenscar runs northeast through the wolds. It rises out of the cars in the first hour, climbs through beech and oak in the second, and breaks at last onto open country in the third, where the wind comes off the sea 20 miles to the east, and the sky becomes the kind of sky that does not interest itself in the doings of those beneath it. Catherine watched the country pass. She had ridden this road perhaps 4 times in her life, and never to its end. Each turning she remembered from childhood. The pollarded lime at the second milestone, the white inn at the fork, arrived now in a sequence that felt deliberate, as though her father had laid the route down for her, milestone by milestone, 8 years before, and only now permitted her to walk it. Catherine pressed her palm flat against the inner wall of the carriage. Then, deliberately, she took it away and set both hands in her lap. Mrs. Pell, opposite her, looked up from her handkerchief. "My dear," Mrs. Pell said, "what manner of man have we just been collected by?" Catherine considered the question. "I do not yet know," she said. "But I think we have just been collected by a man who has been waiting a very long time to do it." Mrs. Pell did not reply. She, too, watched the country pass. After a time, she removed her bonnet, settled it on the seat beside her, and slept. Ravenscar Park was 3 hours by carriage. It rose out of an oak avenue on the second hour, a long, low country house of pale Lincolnshire stone, set against an autumn sky that had cleared at last into bands of rose and slate. There were 3 lights burning in the lower windows when they arrived, although it was not yet dark. The household, Catherine understood at once, had been told to expect her. She had not, in fact, been to Ravenscar before. She had heard her father speak of it perhaps 12 times, in passing, in approval, but she had never been brought here, and she had asked, once, when she was 17, why she was not. And her father had said only that the matter was complicated, and that there would be a time, and that the time was not yet. Now, standing at the steps of a house she had never seen, with a man she had met that morning, on the day she had inherited an estate she had not known was hers, Catherine had a very clear and very inconvenient thought. The time had been planned for, by her father, by this man, for a long while. She did not, however, intend to ask about that yet. She intended, first, to take a bath, a meal, and the inventory of every account book that had passed through this estate's stewardship for the last 8 years. She had been raised by her father to read accounts. Augusta had not been able to take that from her, because Augusta had not known she could. The Duke met her in the hall. He did not advance further into the space than was necessary. He stood at a precise 3 paces from the foot of the great stair, neither close enough to crowd the moment, nor far enough to be remote, and he greeted her with the same measured care he had used in the morning room. "I have asked Mrs. Hardy to show you to the Rose Suite," he said. "Mrs. Pell will be lodged in the connecting room. Dinner will be at 7, in the small dining room, if that is not too soon. If you wish to dine in your apartments tonight, I shall send up a tray." Catherine considered the Rose Suite, the connecting room, and the small dining room, as one considers a country whose customs one has not yet learned. She would take dinner at 7, she told him, in the dining room, and thanked him. There was, however, one thing further she should require. He asked, with quiet attention, what it was. She named the account books, the estate accounts of Whitmore Hall, the trust accounts of the Lincolnshire Trust, and any correspondence between himself and her father pertaining to either from 1808 to the present. The Duke looked at her for a moment with the steady, attentive expression of a man who is being precisely informed of something he has long suspected. He answered that she should have them in the library after dinner, that night, yes. They were already in this house. Of course they were, Catherine said very quietly, and went up the stairs. The Rose Suite faced south. Mrs. Hardy, the housekeeper, had laid a fire in it that morning at 6, and there was hot water and 2 ewers and dry towels on a stand, and a pot of late chrysanthemums on the writing desk.
Catherine sat for some minutes on the edge of the bed without removing her gloves. Then she removed her gloves, and her bonnet, and her traveling cloak, and laid them carefully across the chair, and went to the window. The southern lawn ran down to a small lake. A pair of geese moved on the grass. There was nothing at all on the lawn that suggested cruelty, or calculation, or the kind of arithmetic Augusta had practiced for 6 years in the morning room at Whitmore. Catherine watched the geese for a long time. She did not, in those minutes, decide anything. She simply allowed the inside of her chest to slow, gradually, to the rhythm of a house that did not require her to be vigilant. The library at Ravenscar Park was nothing like the library at Whitmore Hall. The library at Whitmore had been her father's room, and, after his death, the room from which Augusta had begun, week by week, to remove its books. 300 volumes sold to a Lincoln dealer in the spring, 200 more in the summer, the maps from the long table in September. By October, there had been more dust than spines on the eastern wall. Catherine had watched it gutted as one watches a forest cleared, and had said nothing, because saying things to Augusta had not, in 6 years, ever produced a different outcome. The library at Ravenscar was full. The shelves climbed 2 stories. There was a fire in the hearth, 3 lamps burning, and on the long oak table, the Duke had ordered a pile of ledgers and 2 stacks of letter bundles tied with red tape. He stood beside the table when she came in. He had changed his coat for a darker one, and she saw, for the first time without a hat to interrupt the line, but his hair fell unfashionably long over his collar. Not slovenly, deliberately. And that his hands, when they rested on the back of a chair, were broad and scarred along the knuckles in a way that gentlemen's hands usually are not. "These are the trust accounts," he said, indicating the right-hand stack. "These are the Whitmore Hall accounts your father required me to audit each Michaelmas. These are the letters between us from 1808 to 1816. You will find that he wrote to me about you a great deal." Catherine moved to the table. She drew the first ledger toward her without sitting. The leather of the cover was worn smooth at the corners, handled, often, by careful hands. She asked from what age her father had begun. The Duke hesitated for the first time since she had met him. The hesitation was not evasion. It was the pause of a man who had long known the answer to a question, and had not, in 8 years, been asked it aloud. He answered that the letters had begun the year she turned 17, and that they had continued every quarter, without exception, for the 8 years since. Catherine sat down at the long table. She drew the first ledger toward her. She opened it. "You will be in the way," she said without looking up, "if you stand there. Sit down, Your Grace, or go somewhere." He chose, after a moment of consideration, to sit. Not at the head of the table, not opposite her, but 2 chairs distant, on her own side, where he could see what she saw. He did not speak. He did not offer help. He had, she realized after a half hour, ordered a pot of tea brought in and set at her right hand, and she had not noticed him doing it. The fire popped behind them. A mantel clock ticked. The library smelled of beeswax and book leather and, more faintly, the wood smoke that drifted through the house from the kitchen end. She read for 40 minutes without speaking. Her finger, moving down the columns of the colliery share ledger, did not waver. The Duke watched her finger move,
and watched her shoulders set as she encountered each entry, and did not interrupt. He had been audited in his time by men with cigars and brandy and the mannerisms of conviction. He had never been audited by a woman in a dark grey gown who had not eaten since breakfast, and who turned each page with a small, exact pressure of the thumb. He found, to his own quiet surprise, that he preferred this kind of audit. He found also that he was, for the first time in 8 years, not at all certain he would survive it. She looked up at last.
She tapped the ledger once with her forefinger.
Your Grace, you have audited Whitmore Hall every Michaelmas for 8 years. The colliery share has earned £6,000 since my father's death. None of it has been spent on the estate. Where is it?
It was in the trust, he answered, held against her majority, which, by the codicil, was the day of the will's reading. Today.
£6,000, she repeated, and he corrected her, gently.
6,043. The April warrant had not yet cleared.
Catherine set both hands flat on the ledger cover, palms down, the way she had set them on the morning room table at Whitmore. She did not weep. She was, in fact, considering, with very great clarity, exactly which questions she meant to ask this man, and in what order, and with what weight.
My stepmother told me in March that there was no money for new boots for Mrs. Pell. My father had been gone 7 months. There was £6,000 in a trust he had drawn for me, and my old governess walked through a Lincolnshire winter in boots that she had stitched the soles of herself 3 times because my stepmother told her there was no money.
You knew this.
I knew the trust was sound, he said. I did not know about the boots.
A coal shifted in the grate. Catherine closed the ledger. She kept her hands on the cover. The clock on the mantel struck the half hour, and the half hour note faded, and the silence went on a moment longer than the Duke had perhaps prepared for.
I will ask you something, she said, and I want a true answer. Why did you not come for me before today?
The Duke leaned back in his chair. He looked, for the first time, his age, or perhaps slightly older than his age. The fire moved on his face. Because your father asked me not to. He believed your stepmother would read any approach from me as an attempt to seize the estate in his lifetime, and that she would have responded by removing you to her sister's house in Norfolk, where I could not have reached you without scandal. He preferred you to remain at Whitmore, where his presence, while he had presence, could protect you, and where my presence, in writing, through the trust, could continue to protect what was yours. She asked what had altered after his death.
The Duke answered without lifting his hands from the chair arms. The will instructed me to appear on the day of its reading, not before, not after. For 7 months I have written to Mr. Hollis every week. Anything I sent to that house would have been intercepted, read, and used against you. And I did not propose to give your stepmother a single piece of paper she could turn into a weapon.
Catherine looked at the fire. She did not look at him. The thinking was not a defensive turn. It was the consideration of a woman absorbing a long letter she had been handed at a moment in which she was not yet ready to read it. The Duke did not press her, and did not move, and did not, by any small adjustment of his hand on the chair arm, signal that he expected her to fill the silence. She filled it, in time, because it was hers to fill.
Your Grace, you have managed an estate for me, in trust, for 8 years. You wrote to my father about me for 8 years. You arrived this morning at a will reading where my stepmother believed she had won, and you walked into that room as though you had been waiting for the day. Why? He did not answer immediately. When he did, he answered without looking at her, looking instead at the fire, as though the fire had become, in that instant, the safest thing in the room to look at. Because your father, 8 years ago, when he placed the trust in my hand, asked me to do one thing more than the trust required. She asked what had been requested of him. The Duke kept his eyes on the fire. He asked me to take care of you, as I judged best, within the bounds of honor, without obligation upon you, without claim on your hand, without your knowledge, until the day I was free to come for you. Catherine considered this. She considered it for nearly a minute, while the fire moved, and the Duke did not look at her. She asked how long he had been free. He answered that he had been free for 7 months. She asked, more quietly, what had bound him before that? And he answered that he had been bound by her father's preference, and by his own. She asked, more quietly still, what had altered? And he turned his head at last, not moving his hand from the chair arm, not closing the small, careful distance of the two chairs between them, and answered, in a voice that had reduced itself to its essential, that he was, now, here. Catherine set the ledger aside. She drew toward her, instead, the topmost letter from the bundle at the Duke's elbow. It had been opened along the seal long ago, opened, read, refolded, and tied back into the bundle by a man who had kept everything in order. She unfolded it. It was her father's handwriting.
Forsyth, the letter began. My Catherine has been reading Latin since Michaelmas. She is uncommonly good at it. I would like her to continue. Please remit £12 to Mr. Lacey, in care of the Lincoln Post, and do not tell me who has paid it. She believes I am paying it. I would prefer she continue to believe so. E.W. Catherine read it 3 times. Then she set it down, carefully, very carefully, and looked at the Duke. She catalogued aloud, in the precise order in which the years had rearranged themselves on the page in front of her. You paid for my Latin, she said, and the Duke answered, without breaking the line of her gaze, that he had paid it for 4 years. She catalogued the Italian. He confirmed, too.
She catalogued the mathematics master, and he answered yes. And she set the letter flat on the table and pressed her thumb against the seam of the fold as though to keep it from refolding itself out of sight.
My stepmother told my father, in 1812, that she had dismissed all of them. She said the household could not afford them.
The Duke held her gaze. He paid them through me, afterwards, he said. They came to the Lincoln Post under your name. Mrs. Pell collected them on Wednesdays. He had thought, until the year he was lost to me, that you continued to believe yourself the recipient of his small, reasonable indulgence. It was, in a manner of speaking, exactly what you were. Catherine looked up. Mrs. Pell was standing in the doorway of the library. She had been guided there by the housekeeper, and was watching the conversation with the slightly stunned expression of a woman who has just heard the secret of her own life named aloud at last.
Catherine met her eyes across the long room.
Did you know? My darling, I did not know who paid them, Mrs. Pell said, gripping her handkerchief in both hands. I knew they were paid. I knew it was not your stepmother, because I was the one who had, at her instruction, written the dismissal letters. I trusted that the man at the other end of the post was a friend of your father's, and that what we were doing was correct. And I did what I was told.
Catherine watched her old governess's hands tighten on the handkerchief, and then loosen, and she said only,
Mrs. Pell, thank you.
Mrs. Pell's reply, my darling girl, came out small and steady, the way a woman who has been holding a position for 6 years finally allows herself to stand at ease. Catherine turned again to the Duke. Her color was very high. Her hands, on the table, were exceptionally still. She could feel, in the precise, distant way one feels the floor of a stage, that she was not yet weeping, and that she was very near to weeping, and that the choice between the two would be hers. She chose the color and the stillness, and one further question.
I have one more, Your Grace, and then I am going to sleep. Why did my father trust you with this?
The Duke considered the fire. Then he considered Catherine. He answered in a voice that had gone, somewhere in the last minute, slightly rough. Because when I was 20, and my own father was lost to me, and I inherited a title I did not yet know how to wear, your father sat at my table for 7 nights running, until I had stopped wanting to sell the family seat to the crown to be free of it.
He taught me to keep accounts. He taught me to write to tenants. He set the brandy aside, untasted.
The fire moved in the grate. The half-hour bell did not yet sound.
He stood as second when I was foolish enough to be drawn into a duel I did not need to fight, and he kept me from being harmed in it. And afterwards, he wrote me a letter that I have never shown to another person, and that I keep in the drawer of the desk in this room. He was the only father I had after the age of 19. He looked then, not at the fire, but at her. He trusted me with this, because he had spent his life proving that he could, and because he believed that I would, and because he had the singularly inconvenient habit in the matters of those he loved, of being very nearly always right. The library was very quiet. Catherine rose. She walked the length of the table. At the door she paused, palm flat by old habit, on the doorframe, and turned. "Tomorrow," she said, "I should like to begin the audit at 9:30.
9:30, said the Duke. She lifted her hand from the doorframe and went up to bed.
She did not sleep much. She read, instead, 4 years of letters from the bundles he had laid out, sitting up against the pillows of a bed she had never slept in, with a single candle on the small night table. She cried twice, quietly, briefly, the way one cries when one has finally been given permission to. The first time was at a letter dated the November of her 19th year, in which her father had written, "She read me the whole of Cicero's first oration last evening, in better Latin than I had at Cambridge, and I did not say so because I did not wish her to be vain. I should have said so. I shall say so tomorrow. E.W. The second time was at a letter dated the spring of her father's last year, which said only, "Forsyth, I am tired now. I have a daughter who deserves a steady hand at the rudder when I am no longer at it. I have asked you to take care of her, and you have agreed. I shall not ask again. Be patient, and be exact, and choose the day yourself." E.W. She washed her face in cold water at 4 a.m, and she slept, finally, until 8. In the morning, she came down at 9:20. She had put on the dark grey gown that was the most respectable of the two she owned, and had tied her hair in a knot so plain it was almost an instruction to the mirror. She found him already at the long table. He had also, she suspected, not slept much. There was no particular sign of it on his face, but his coffee cup had been refilled twice before her arrival, and he wore the coat she had seen the night before, which a man who slept did not. He poured her tea without asking, and did not, she noticed, offer milk or sugar. He had remembered, from the night before, that she took it plain. It was a small thing. It was, in audio terms, in the terms of any honest accounting between two people, not a small thing at all. They worked. What followed in the next 10 days was not romance. It would not have been recognized as romance by anyone watching from the windows. It would have been recognized, by anyone who understood account books, as the dismantling of a 6-year deception. The trust ledgers were sound. The Whitmore Hall ledgers, by contrast, were not. Augusta had been drawing on a household allowance that had no warrant in any document Catherine's father had ever signed. She had been paying her own milliner from estate funds. She had been settling Cassius's London debts from the Connery profits. Mr. Hollis arrived on the third day with 2 clerks and a great many sharpened pens, and the long oak table acquired the disordered look of a battlefield map. Ledger spread over ledger, letters anchored by paperweights, inkpots in unlikely places, 2 cups of tea cooling between them. The Duke withdrew, at this point, to the duties of his own estate, and reappeared in the evenings at dinner, where he listened to Catherine's findings with the patient attentiveness of a man for whom the right answer had never been obvious, and was only being uncovered by the evidence in front of him. His attentiveness was particular. He did not nod for the sake of nodding, and he did not interrupt to demonstrate that he had already understood. He listened until a fact had been wholly delivered, and then asked the one question that had not yet been answered. Catherine had, in 6 years at Whitmore, never been listened to in this fashion. She found she did not at first know how to answer the questions.
By the end of the second evening, she did. By the end of the fourth, she was looking forward to them. There was banter, too, which she had not expected. She had taken him, on first meeting, for a man who had stopped speaking lightly some time before 20. She was wrong. The Duke spoke lightly when his estate was running well, when his ledgers were balanced, and when the woman at the other end of his table was... The realization came to him slowly, and then all at once, on the fourth evening, looking, every now and again, as though she might allow herself to laugh. It happened on the fifth evening, after Mrs. Hardy had cleared the soup. Catherine had, it turned out, been told a number of things about the household by the housekeeper that morning, and arrived at dinner armed with at least one of them. "Your Grace," she said, "I have been told by your housekeeper that you do not, ordinarily, take dinner in the small dining room." He confirmed it. He ordinarily took dinner, she pressed gently. "Where?" He answered, "At the long desk in the library, with a single candle, and whatever could be brought up on a tray." And why, then, were they at present in the small dining room? "Because," he said, and the corner of his mouth moved very slightly. Mrs. Hardy had informed him, with considerable feeling, that a young lady could not eat a good Lincolnshire mutton off a tray at a desk, that she would not allow it under her roof, and that if he persisted in his eccentricities, he might do so alone after Miss Whitmore had retired. Catherine considered her plate. She observed, evenly, that Mrs. Hardy was a person of strong opinions. The Duke confirmed, equally evenly, that Mrs. Hardy had raised him. She permitted herself, then, to laugh. It was a small laugh, surprised almost, and the Duke, for the first time in 8 years, set down his fork in the middle of a meal and forgot about it entirely. The fire burned in the grate. Mrs. Pell, who had been pretending to attend to her own plate at the Duke's left, allowed herself, for the duration of about half a second, the smallest tightening of the corner of her mouth that was, by Mrs. Pell's standards, a riot. By the seventh morning, the post brought trouble. Mrs. Pell came into the small parlor with a letter on a silver salver. The seal was Augustus. Catherine read it. Then she read it a second time, more slowly, and laid it flat on the table, and pressed it down with the heel of her hand, the way one pins a moth to be examined. "She is bringing suit in the Chancery Court at Lincoln," she said. "She is asking the court to set aside the will, on the grounds that my father was not of sound mind when the codicil was drawn, and on the grounds that the trustee, that is, the Duke, exercised undue influence over him in the trust's establishment, and on the grounds that I, being an unmarried young woman of 25, am incompetent to manage an estate without the protection of a relation, and that the suitable relation is herself." Mrs. Pell sat down rather suddenly. "And she has named the date," Catherine went on. "The 15th of November, in Lincoln, open court. She has, additionally, sent a copy of the petition to the local newspapers." The local newspapers? Yes. My dear, why would she send it to the newspapers? Catherine traced the seal with her thumb. The wax was a darker red than Augusta usually used. She had, perhaps, been at her sister's stationer in Norwich. "Because she believes that the Duke's reputation will not survive a public hearing in which an unmarried young woman has been removed from her stepmother's house and lodged in his." "She had a chaperone," he reminded her. She answered that she had him. He said, evenly, that she was a governess. She answered that he was her chaperone. She was, she insisted, his former governess. The newspapers would not see it that way. "No," he agreed. "They would not." She folded the letter. She sat very still for a moment, her hand pressed flat against the small parlor table. Then she rose and went to find the Duke. She found him in the stable yard. He had been schooling a young horse, a chestnut filly, all leg and uncertainty, and he had handed her over to a groom and was wiping his hands on a cloth when Catherine came into the yard. He looked up. He read her face in the time it took her to cross the cobbles, and asked, in a voice low enough that the groom did not turn, what had happened. She told him in 3 sentences. A chancery suit, a date, 3 grounds, the newspapers.
The grounds, she said, she would lay out inside. He set the cloth down. He did not, however, lead her inside. He glanced once at the high stable doors, beyond which the chestnut filly was now standing with her ears at a critical angle, and turned instead to the small wooden gate at the southern corner of the yard. The garden is closer, he said. It is quieter, and we will not be overheard by Mrs. Hardy, who has the hearing of a barn owl. The walled garden had been the kitchen garden once, and was now half a flower garden. Apple trees against the south wall, the last asters of October bowed against the box hedge, a stone bench under a yew. He gestured to the bench. He did not sit. He stood in front of her, with the cloth still in his hand, and listened while she told him the three grounds. When she had finished, he was quiet for a moment. Then he said, "Of the three, the first is impossible. The second is grotesque. The third is the one she will press hardest, because the third is the one the public will care about." "Yes." He paused at the south wall, looked at it, and then at her. "There was," he said, "a way to remove the third ground from the petition." Catherine answered, before he had finished the sentence, that she knew what it was. He looked at her steadily. She looked back. It was not a yes. It was the recognition that the conversation had now arrived at the place neither of them had wanted, but both of them had known they would. He looked at the asters for a moment, and then at the south wall, and then, finally, carefully, at her. "I would not raise it in this hour of all hours, except that the hearing is in 18 days. I will not raise it as a matter of necessity." She asked what, then, he proposed to raise it as. He drew one breath. He let it out. He answered, with the slow precision of a man who had been preparing the sentence for years, and had, at last, the right hour to say it in. "I will not raise it as anything," he said. "I will only say what is true. Your father's last wish, written in a letter I have never shown you, was that I should ask you, when the time came, and only when the time came, whether you would consent to be my wife. He did not require it of me. He did not require it of you. He asked it, as a wish. And I am going to honor him by asking it. Not now, not in this hour, but soon. And you may answer however your honor and your good sense dictate, and the asking, whatever your answer, will not alter the trust, will not alter the protection of this house, will not alter what I owe to him or to you. The asking is mine. The answer is yours. Wholly, and without consequence to anything else." Catherine sat down on the bench. The asters moved in a small wind. A magpie crossed the south wall, carried on its own purposes, indifferent to the conversation beneath it. The stone of the bench was cold through the wool of her gown. Her hand, in her lap, did not press itself flat against anything. It lay open. "Your Grace," she said, "you have just told me that the last wish of my father, who I am, at this exact moment, missing very greatly, was that I should marry you, if I should choose, and that you have been carrying this knowledge for 7 months, and intended to carry it for some indefinite further period of time before mentioning it to me at all, and would not have mentioned it to me today, were it not for an emergency that it is now uncertain whether it solves." He confirmed it with the smallest movement of his head. Catherine looked at him. She looked at the apple wall, and the grass, and the impossible, ridiculous arithmetic of a man who had spent 8 years preparing for a moment he had then refused to take. "You are an extraordinary fool of a man, Your Grace." He answered, without taking offense, that he had been told so before, by her father, on more than one occasion. She laughed then. She laughed in a way that startled both of them, and pressed her hand to her mouth, and looked away from him at the apple trees, and felt, for the first time in almost a year, the particular kind of warmth that one experiences when grief and humor and astonishment arrive in the same exact moment and decide between themselves to be allies. The wind moved in the apples. A cooking smell from the kitchen end of the house drifted across the wall, bread and something with thyme, and she found, briefly,
that she was hungry, which she had not been since the funeral.
Your Grace.
Yes. I am not going to answer you today. I am going to think. In the meantime, we have a chancery hearing in 18 days, 3 newspaper articles to forestall, an unaudited 14th ledger from Whitmore Hall to retrieve, and a stepmother to defeat. Will you sit down? He sat down on the bench beside her. He did not sit close. He did not sit far. He sat exactly the way a man sits beside a woman he has waited 8 years to sit beside, and will not, by the smallest disposition of his weight, presume more of than has been offered. They sat for some minutes without speaking. She did not press her palm flat against anything. She let her hands lie in her lap. He kept the cloth in his. She asked, after a time, what the chestnut filly's name was. He answered that the filly had not yet been named. She asked his habit, and he told her, when a horse came to him, bought from a dealer who had not been kind, he waited until she showed him her temper, and then named her for it. She asked what the filly's temper was. The Duke turned the cloth in his hands, considered the wall, and gave the answer with the small, puzzled care of a man who had not yet, and 38 years' acquaintance with horses, met one of this particular kind. The filly, he said, did not flinch when she was touched. She flinched when she was praised. He was uncertain what to make of it. Catherine considered this. She rose. I have known another creature like that, she said, and walked out of the garden, leaving him on the bench with the cloth still in his hand, and a feeling wholly new, wholly unexpected, and entirely unlike anything he had felt during 8 years of dutiful care, of having been seen, exactly, for the first time in his adult life. The week before the hearing was a week of strategy, which is a colorless way of describing what was, in fact, the most active week Catherine had ever spent. She spent 4 days drafting, with Mr. Hollis, the response to Augusta's petition. The legal answer was straightforward. The Chancery Court could not set aside a will on the grounds of undue influence, without evidence of contemporary protest from the testator. And there was none. There were, instead, 18 years of documented correspondence in her father's hand, in which he had repeatedly described the Duke as the man who was holding his daughter's inheritance, because no one else could be relied upon to do so. The first ground would fall on the documents. The second would fall on Mr. Hollis's testimony. The third, the one about Catherine being incompetent to manage an estate without a male relation, would fall on Catherine. Mr. Hollis explained the procedure on the afternoon of the 8th day. He had taken off his spectacles to do it, and laid them on the table between them. She would be asked, he said, to read aloud from an estate ledger in open court. She asked which one. He answered, whichever her counsel offered, and they would not warn her. She told him she had been reading estate ledgers since she was 14. Mr. Hollis answered, in the gentle voice of a man delivering the only fact in the case still hidden from her, that they would not, in the courtroom, know that. They will, Catherine said, and laid her own hand flat beside his spectacles. Because I will read aloud from the ledger they offer, with my reasons for the lines, and my recommendations for the next quarter. And I will do it from memory, because I have been audited by the Duke's office for the past 10 days, and I have memorized the Eastern Farms. Mr. Hollis put his spectacles back on. He looked at her over them, and then through them, and said, in the tone of a man making a slow, private decision, your father was a remarkable man. It is becoming clear to me, in my old age, that he was not the most remarkable Whitmore. Catherine flushed. Mr. Hollis. Forgive me, an old man's sentiment. Let us return to the petition. That evening, the Duke came back from the Eastern Farms with mud on his boots and a packet of letters under his arm. He set the packet on the long library table without removing his coat. The mud on his boots was the kind a man acquires by walking the boundaries of a tenancy in November. Clay, reed stems, 2 miles of cart track. And his face was the face of a man who had, in the course of an afternoon, persuaded 4 of Sir Edmund Whitmore's tenants to sign declarations against their own dread of legal proceedings. They have signed declarations, he said.
They will travel to Lincoln on the 15th. The Latin master will also speak. He has come up from Lincoln this evening at his own expense. He is in the small parlor.
Catherine repeated the name back to him, Mr. Lacey, and he confirmed it with the small inclination of a man who had been arranging this particular meeting for 9 days. She went to the small parlor. Mr. Lacey was a thin, elderly man in a clerical coat who had not been allowed to teach her since she was 16 because Augusta had decided his fees were extortionate. He stood when she came in. He looked at her, and looked at the floor, and looked at her again, and then he wept, properly, briefly, without apology, and she crossed to him and put her hand on his sleeve and let him weep.
He apologized in the small voice of a man who had carried a question for years and had only just been given permission to ask it. She answered him, gently, that there was nothing to forgive. He had been paid, he said, all these years. She answered that she knew. He named his payer, his Grace, and she answered, again, that she knew. He confessed, with a dry, halting note, that he had wondered all this while why she had stopped writing to him, and she shook her head and told him she had not stopped, that her letters had been intercepted, and that she had assumed, in the absence of his replies, that he had decided she was not worth his trouble. Mr. Lacey looked at the floor again. He had, in his life, taught Latin to 7 dukes' sons and 1 earl's grandson, and he had thought he had seen most varieties of family arrangement. He had not seen this one. He cleared his throat with the small, dignified cough of a man preparing to make a small, dignified offer. I shall be in Lincoln on the 15th. Will you read with me before then? We have 10 days.
I will permit you, Catherine said, and I shall be grateful. Cicero or Virgil, Mr. Lacey?
Which?
Mr. Lacey considered the question with the gravity it deserved.
Cicero, if I may. I think we shall need Cicero. She went up the stairs to her rooms. The Duke had passed her in the hall, on his way out, with no more than a nod, and she had not stopped him. She had, instead, gone to her room and shut the door, and sat down on the edge of the bed and held her father's watch in her hand for a long time. The watch ticked. Outside, a wind had risen against the eastern face of the house. Somewhere in the stable yard, the chestnut filly, who had not yet been named, whinnied at a sound only she could hear. The watch's tick was louder than the wind, and the wind was louder than the filly. And Catherine sat with the 3 sounds arranged around her like the 3 voices of a quiet choir, and thought. That night she wrote a letter. She wrote it to her father. She did not address it. She did not seal it. She did not intend to send it. She wrote it because there were things she had needed to say to him before he left her, and which she had not been permitted to say, because he had been ill quickly and gone quickly after, and Augusta had been at the bedside, and Catherine had been kept to the hall. She wrote it for an hour. The candle burned down by a half. She did not, in that hour, raise her head from the page. When she was done, she folded it, and she went down to the library, and she put it inside the drawer of the long desk in the library. The drawer the Duke had mentioned on the first night contained the only letter from her father he had never shown another person. And she closed the drawer without opening it, and went up to bed. In the morning, the Duke saw the corner of her letter where she had not quite closed it. He did not open the drawer. He touched the wood once with the flat of his hand, and went to breakfast. The 15th of November came in Lincoln, under a sky of cold blue. The wind was off the wolds. The cathedral bells, from the upper city, struck 9 as the carriage drew up at the old castle quarter. There was a small crowd already gathered at the Chancery Court door, a paper and pencil crowd, not a torch and pitchfork crowd, but a crowd nonetheless. And a man in a brown coat with a notebook tried to catch Catherine's eye as she stepped down. The Duke stepped between them without seeming to. Catherine did not, in the event, look up. The Chancery Court at Lincoln was a long, panelled room in the old castle quarter, with high windows and a fire that did not quite warm the gallery. By 10 o'clock, the gallery was full. Augusta had done her work,
The newspapers had run her petition for 9 days, and the public had decided it was a romance. The wicked stepmother, the orphaned heiress, the gallant duke, the rumored midnight elopement. The truth, which was duller and more complete, had not entered the headlines. Catherine sat at the petitioner's table beside Mr. Hollis. She wore the dark gray gown. Her hair was plain. She had her father's watch in the inner pocket of her cloak. The Duke was not at the petitioner's table. He was at his own table, on the other side of the room, with his counsel, because the petition had named him as a respondent in his capacity as trustee. He did not look at her.
He had not looked at her since they had entered the building.
She understood why. So did he. They would speak afterwards. Augusta sat at the opposite table. She wore black silk and pearls. Her face was the face she had worn at the funeral. Cassius sat behind her. He had come up from London for the hearing in a coat too tight at the shoulder, and he kept tugging at the cuff in a way that suggested either nerves or an ill-fitting tailor. The bench entered. The court rose. Catherine, rising with the rest, felt the watch in her cloak press once against her ribs, and steadied herself on the table edge with the flat of her gloved hand. The hearing began. Augusta's counsel was a Mr. Beverley, handsome, expensive, 28 years old, clearly hired for his appearance as much as his learning. He opened with the first ground, the testator's mental incompetence. He called Augusta. She wept neatly into a handkerchief. She told the court her husband had been unsteady in his last years. She produced no evidence. Mr. Hollis cross-examined her with the gentleness of a man holding a scalpel at a precise angle. He produced, in the space of 9 minutes, 3 letters from her late husband to the bank, 2 letters to Parliament, and 1 letter to his daughter, all written in the year of his death, all unimpeachably lucid. Augusta's counsel withdrew the first ground before the bench could rule on it. He moved to the second ground, undue influence by the trustee. He called the Duke. He attempted to imply, in the polite circumlocutions of the Chancery Bar, that the Duke had positioned himself near the testator over a period of years for the purpose of acquiring control of the estate. The Duke listened. He answered, when asked, with the brevity of a man who had been waiting for the question and saw no reason to extend it. Mr. Hollis then produced the 18-year correspondence. He read 3 letters aloud. The third was the one in which Catherine's father had written, in 1812, that he would sooner trust the Duke of Ravenscar with his daughter than any kinsman he had on earth. The gallery, which had come for a romance, fell briefly silent. The second ground was withdrawn before the noon adjournment. The court rose for the noon hour. Catherine and Mr. Hollis took the meal at a small chop house in the lower town. She ate steadily, not from appetite, but from discipline. Mr. Hollis, whose appetite at 64 was that of a man at 64, ate less than usual, and watched her, and said nothing of the afternoon to come. When the court reconvened at 1:30, the gallery was, if anything, fuller. Word had travelled that the second ground had collapsed, and the city had come to see whether the third would too. Mr. Beverley returned with the third ground. He had, evidently, decided to make a meal of it. "Miss Whitmore," he said, "would you stand?" Catherine stood. Her hands rested at her sides. She did not press them flat against anything. "You are 25 years old.
"I am."
"You are unmarried."
"I am."
"You have, since the death of your father, been residing in the household of a bachelor duke."
"I have been residing in his country seat," Catherine said, "with my former governess as my companion, in apartments at the eastern end of the house, under the supervision of a housekeeper of 40 years standing in his employ."
"Yes."
"And before that?"
"Before that, I resided in my father's house with my stepmother, who is the petitioner in this action."
"Quite so. Miss Whitmore, do you consider yourself competent to manage the estates left to you by your father?"
"I do."
He asked her on what basis.
She answered, without raising her voice, "On the basis of having read estate accounts since she was 14 years of age, of having been instructed in mathematics, Latin, Italian,
and the principles of agricultural management by tutors paid for over the past 4 years through the trust established by her father in her name, and of having spent the last 11 days auditing the books of Whitmore Hall in conjunction with Mr. Hollis and his clerks. She added, without breaking her gaze from the bench, that she had prepared, for the court's convenience, a summary of her findings, and would be glad to read from it.
"That will not be, my lord," said Mr. Hollis, rising. "We offer Miss Whitmore's audit summary in evidence."
"Granted," said the bench.
Mr. Beverley sat down, briefly, and rose again, with the grim determination of a man who had been instructed to push a particular line of attack, and had decided that retreat was, at this moment, more humiliating than defeat.
"Very well, Miss Whitmore. If you are competent, perhaps you will read for the court from this." He held up a ledger. The clerk passed it across. It was the colliery share ledger for 1815.
"Page?"
"Whichever you like." "Page 47, Catherine said. The clerk opened it to page 47 and set it before her. The room went still. Catherine looked once at the ledger, and once at Mr. Hollis, and once, briefly, aloud only to herself, at the Duke, who was sitting very straight at the respondent's table, with his hands folded together on its surface. He did not look at her. His hands, she saw, were exceptionally still.
She read the entries. She read the totals. She explained the deductions for transport, the deductions for warrant fees, the deductions for the late installment from the Lincoln Assayer's office, the reasons for the unusual September dividend, and the reason, given in a footnote in her father's hand, which she now read aloud, for which the colliery share had been retained in the trust rather than credited to the household account. She read for 11 minutes. The gallery did not move. Mr. Beverley, by the 8th minute, was watching her with the expression of a man who has bet on the wrong horse and who is becoming aware, by the slow turn of the field, of which horse is in fact going to come in. Augusta was not watching Catherine.
She was watching the bench, and the bench was watching Catherine. And Augusta, who had spent 6 years estimating Catherine's silence as competence's absence, was, Catherine realized in the 11th minute, finally and at last understanding what she had been sitting opposite at breakfast.
"Miss Whitmore," said the bench when she had finished.
"That will do."
Catherine sat down. The court was silent. The bench rose.
"On the third ground, the petitioner's contention that Miss Catherine Whitmore is incompetent to manage the estates left to her in trust, this court finds, on the evidence presented, that the petitioner's contention is wholly without foundation. The third ground is dismissed. The petition is dismissed in its entirety. The trust stands. Costs to the respondents."
Augusta did not weep. Augusta sat very still in her black silk, and her face did the slow thing that Catherine had seen 6 weeks earlier in the morning room window. The calculation of the next move.
There was, at this point, no next move. The court had ruled. The papers would print the ruling. The ledgers had been read aloud. There would be no second hearing. Augusta knew it. So did Cassius. So did everyone in the panelled room. Mr. Beverley bowed to the bench, gathered his papers, and did not look at his client. In the hall outside the courtroom, the Duke crossed to Catherine and bowed and said, in the lowered voice of a man recovering a privacy taken from him for the morning, "I should like to take you to dinner. There is a private room at the George. They have set a fire. Mrs. Pearl is already there. I sent her ahead an hour ago. She has been weeping into the table linen since 11 this morning, and I thought it would be kindest to give her a fire and a glass of sherry while we settled the matter in court."
"Your Grace, you are an extraordinarily kind man."
"I have been told so, by your father, on more than one occasion." She put her hand on his sleeve.
It was the first time she had touched him deliberately. The first time. She felt, beneath the wool of his coat, the steadiness of him. Not surprised by her hand, and not unmoved by it, but simply, particularly, present.
He did not put his hand over hers. He did not need to. They walked down the corridor of the old castle quarter, Catherine's hand on his arm, Mr. Hollis a discreet 2 paces behind, and out into a Lincoln evening that was already darkening towards the early winter dusk. The light in the lower city was the color of weak tea. A boy was selling chestnuts at the cathedral corner. A woman in a gray shawl, standing in a doorway, watched them pass with the impassive regard of a townswoman who had learned, in 20 winters of Lincoln gossip, never to admit to having recognized a duke. Catherine kept her hand on his sleeve. The private room at the George was small and warm. Mrs. Pell was at the fire. She had, in fact, stopped weeping by the time they arrived. She was, instead, on her second glass of sherry, and was pinker about the cheeks than Catherine had seen her in 6 years. Mrs. Pell asked whether the Connery ledger had been read. Catherine confirmed it. Mrs. Pell asked whether it had been from memory. Catherine confirmed that, too. Mrs. Pell observed, with a satisfaction that the sherry had not, in fact, supplied, but had merely warmed, that Mr. Lacey would be very pleased. Catherine answered that Mr. Lacey was in the public gallery. She had seen him as she had stood. Mrs. Pell, who had known he would be, accepted the news with the small finality of a governess whose forecasts had been, on this question as on most, exact. The Duke ordered the dinner. He ordered, Catherine noticed, 3 glasses of the inn's best claret, and a roast pheasant, and a syllabub for Mrs. Pell, who had a known and unrepentant fondness for syllabub. They sat. They ate. They spoke of nothing of consequence. Mrs. Pell, who was beginning to understand a great many things she had not understood at the start of the day, kept her counsel and ate her syllabub. Towards the end of the meal, Mrs. Pell announced, with a degree of dignity slightly assisted by sherry, that she was going to walk in the inn yard and look at the stars, and that nobody was to follow her, and that she would return in precisely 20 minutes, at which point she would expect to be escorted to her bedchamber. She left. The door closed. The fire shifted in the grate. A coachman in the yard called to a horse. Somewhere in the upper rooms of the inn, a door opened and shut. Catherine looked at the Duke. The Duke looked at the fire. They sat in the small private room at the George Hotel in Lincoln on the evening of the 15th of November, 1816, and the silence between them was not a silence of awkwardness. It was the silence of 2 people who have arrived, by long and separate routes, at the same hour, and who are perhaps, for the first time, both of them aware of it.
"Your Grace," she said, "it has been 18 days. You said you would ask me."
"I said I would ask you. Soon."
"This is soon enough."
He set down his glass. He did not, she noticed, take her hand. He had not taken her hand once in 18 days, except to hand her into a carriage, which was a duty, and once to lift her down from the chestnut filly, which was nearly a duty. He sat opposite her, and asked her, formally, plainly, exactly, whether she would consent to be his wife. Catherine considered him. She considered the ledger he had kept in trust for 8 years, the 4 years of Latin payments and the 2 years of Italian, Mrs. Pell's boots, Mr. Lacey's tears, the 18-year correspondence, and the fact that he had not opened the drawer of the long desk to read the letter she had written to her father, although the corner had been visible. She considered, last of all, the particular steadiness of his right hand on the back of his chair, which had not moved in some moments, and the careful, quiet face of a man whom she had, somewhere between the morning room and this private room, come to know.
"Your Grace," she said, "I have one condition."
"Name it."
"You will not ever, for so long as we are both alive, refer to this evening's proposal as the rescue of an unmarried young woman from a chancery court. You will not refer to it as a duty fulfilled to my late father. You will not refer to it as the necessary consequence of a public hearing. You will refer to it, when you refer to it, as what it actually is, which is the consequence of having known me, in part, for 10 weeks, and in full, for 11 days, and of having decided, Against your considerable original intention to remain my trustee for some indefinite period of my majority, that you would prefer not to.
Yes, he said. I accept the condition. And yes, that is the consequence.
Then yes, Your Grace.
Yes, what?
Yes, I will marry you. He closed his eyes. He did not, even now, take her hand.
He was, she realized, with a small, clear pang of love that she would not call by that name yet. A man who had been waiting for this moment for so long that he was being very careful in the moment itself, not to break it by moving too quickly. She did not, herself, propose to wait. She rose. She crossed to him. She put her hand deliberately on his cheek, and he opened his eyes and looked up at her, and she bent and kissed him, once, briefly, exactly the way one signs a name to a contract one has read carefully and intends to honor. He did not, even then, grab. He raised his hands to her wrist, gently, and held it there, warm, steady, scarred along the knuckles. And that, between them, was the first kiss.
When Mrs. Pearl returned from the inn yard, precisely 20 minutes later, having looked at the stars, she found Catherine and the Duke seated decorously on opposite sides of the table, with two slightly disturbed glasses of claret between them. And she observed, with the practiced eye of a governess, that something had been settled, and asked no questions, and proposed bed. They were married in the small chapel at Ravenscar Park on the 2nd of January, in the new year, by a Lincolnshire bishop who had known Sir Edmund Whitmore for 30 years, and who, before the service, took Catherine's hand in his and said only, "He would have been very pleased, my child," and turned away to put on his vestments before either of them could compose a reply. The chapel was small. The congregation was smaller. Mrs. Pell, Mrs. Hardy, Mr. Hollis, 4 tenants from the Eastern Farms, Lacey, 2 cousins of the Duke's whose names Catherine had only learned the previous evening, and a sleeping spaniel belonging to one of the cousins, which was, on the whole, the best behaved of the assembled. The bishop's voice, in the small space, sounded twice, once as a man's voice, and once as the chapel's echo. And when he pronounced them married, the echo arrived a half-beat after, like a witness too old to hurry. Augusta did not attend. Augusta had retired, by mutual agreement of the trust and her remaining counsel, to her sister's house in Norfolk, with the South Wing's pin money intact, and a quiet understanding that she would not be welcomed at Lincolnshire society for some considerable time. Cassius had been packed off to a position with a cousin in the East India Company that he had not requested, and had not been given the option to refuse. He wrote, 6 months later, from Calcutta, a letter of the kind young men write when they have begun to suspect that ill-tailored coats may not, after all, be the worst fate that might have befallen them. Catherine read it. She wrote a short reply. She did not, as Augusta would have, mention any of it ever again. In April, the chestnut filly, who had by then been named Cicero on Catherine's stubborn insistence and Mr. Lacey's quiet delight, was put to her first proper schooling under saddle. She did not flinch when she was touched. She flinched once when Catherine said, "Good girl," and then, the second time, did not flinch, because Catherine had laid her gloved hand against the filly's neck in the same exact moment, palm flat, the way Catherine had once pressed her palm against doorframes. Cicero had, by that exchange, learned the difference between a praise that asked for something in return and a praise that did not. So, by then, had Catherine. By June, the library at Whitmore Hall, which had been sold, book by book, over Augusta's 6-year tenancy, had been bought back. It had taken letters to dealers in Lincoln, in Cambridge, in London, and in 2 Norfolk villages whose proprietors had been startled, on receipt of a Duke's inquiry, to discover that the volumes they had bought from a Lady Whitmore for 19 shillings were now being requested back at fair purchase price. One dealer had returned a particular volume, a 1789 edition of Ovid in calf, without charge, and with a note that said only, "Sir Edmund signed the flyleaf to me in 1797. Please return it to his daughter."
The volume came in a small parcel, tied with butcher's string. Catherine opened it on the long oak table at Ravenscar with steady hands. She read the flyleaf. She did not weep.
She set the volume on the shelf between Cicero and Virgil, because that was where her father had always kept his Ovid, and because she had decided that Whitmore Hall, when it was opened again, would have the shelves arranged in his order. Catherine wound her father's silver pocket watch on the morning of her wedding, and on the morning of every Michaelmas thereafter, with the same small, exact gesture. Thumb against the crown, three half turns, then closed. The watch had stopped on the morning of his last hour, at 4:20. It had been started again, at 4:20 on the afternoon she went to Ravenscar, by the Duke himself, who had laid it into her palm at the carriage door without explanation, and who had said only, when she asked him later why he had wound it, "It seemed to me that he would have wished it to keep moving." The watch kept moving.
In the spring of the year after their marriage, Catherine sat at the long table in the library at Ravenscar Park, with the ledger open in front of her, the colliery accounts, Michaelmas quarter, and wrote a small annotation in the margin, a footnote, in her own hand, exactly in the manner her father had done. Her husband sat two chairs distant on the same side of the table, where he could see what she saw, and did not interrupt. The fire moved on the long wall. Mrs. Hardy, who had been, all morning, in a state of particular satisfaction, came in twice to refill the pot of tea and to say, on the second occasion, that supper would be at 7 in the small dining room, and that under no circumstances would a tray be permitted in this house ever again. Catherine looked up. She caught her husband's eye. He was not, at this moment, looking at the ledger.
He was looking at her, at the curve of her neck where firelight had caught it, at the small ink stain on her left forefinger, at the steady, unhurried way her hand moved across the page.
"You are not," she said, "at present attending to the ledger."
"I am not."
"What are you attending to?"
"You."
"Why?" He considered the question with the careful, unhurried attention he gave to all questions worth answering. He answered finally, in the voice of a man who had been waiting for 9 years now, to say it without complication.
"Because you are the most particular thing I have ever been asked to look after, and the only one I have ever wanted to belong to in return. And I am not yet, I think I shall never be entirely, over the small, daily astonishment of looking up from a ledger and finding you in the room."
Catherine pressed her palm flat against the table. She kept it there. She did not move it away. She let it be seen.
"I love you," she said.
"I know."
"Did you know?"
"I have known, Catherine, for some weeks now. You have been very precise about it."
"How?"
"You wound my pocket watch on Tuesday, without remark, as one winds a thing that belongs to one."
"Ah,"
she smiled. She closed the ledger. She did not, this time, take her hand from the table. He reached, then, slowly, carefully, the way he reached for everything, and laid his own broad, scarred hand over hers, palm down, fingers steady, and they sat for some time in the firelight without speaking, while the chestnut filly cried out from the stable yard, once, as she had on Catherine's first night at Ravenscar, and was answered by a groom who had been schooled by his master to recognize the particular note of her impatience, with the soft, warm voice of a man who had been taught, by a woman in a grey gown with steady hands, that praise need not always ask for something in return. Outside, an April sun moved across the south wall of the kitchen garden. The watch, in its small, exact pocket, kept moving. So, at the long table in the library at Ravenscar Park, did her husband's hand on hers. Not in claim, not in custody, but in the quiet, daily, ordinary settlement of two people who had been, by the slow, careful patience of one stubborn man and the steady, clear eye of one composed woman, brought at last into the same room, in the same hour, on the same side of the table, where they intended to remain. If you have ever been the quiet one in the corner, the daughter the room forgot,
the woman the family underestimated, the heart that kept its accounts in private because no one had ever asked to read them. I should very much like to know, in the comments, which scene tonight you carried with you into your own evening. Tell me. I read every one. And if you would like another fireside story tomorrow, you know where to find the bell. Sleep warm. The fire will be lit again.